Hebrews has shown in the first chapter or two that Jesus was greater than the angels. He was also greater than the prophets. Now in the third chapter, but also in the second chapter, showed that Jesus had condescended unto the cross, stooped to it, in order to bring many sons unto glory, and in order to bring to naught him that had the power over death, that is the devil, and that he might qualify himself as a merciful and great high priest. Now these things were accomplished in his stooping under the cross and death. Now, with that before them, he now wants to move unto Moses and show that Jesus was greater than Moses. And you can imagine how that would hit the average Jew to talk about anybody being greater than Moses. We'll talk about his greatness in just a few moments and why they would feel that way. But it would be something like an individual coming to me and trying to show me why Joseph Smith is greater than Jesus Christ, or to show me why the Pope of Rome is the vicar of Christ, the representative of Christ. I would have a hard time accepting that. Well, I can understand how the Jew would feel about the Christ as being greater than Moses. And so the writer now sets in to show that Jesus is greater than Moses. And then he's going to pass on in chapter 5, chapter 4, rather, that the rest God offers is greater than the rest that God ever offered them or promised in Canaan. And then he moves to Aaron and shows that Jesus is greater than Aaron as a high priest, so much as Melchizedek was greater than the Aaronic priesthood back in the Old Testament. So all the way through, the writer is developing that idea of the fact that everything under the new is better than that of the old, is greater. And this was to hinder these individuals from going back to the old covenant, or trying to go back, rather, to the old order of things. Now in this chapter here, chapter 3, he begins by saying, "Wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, even Jesus." Right? Then he goes on to show from that wherein it was greater. Let's look at that for just a moment. This word "wherefore" looks back to what he has said up to this particular point, on the ground of what he has said concerning Christ and angels, Christ and the prophets, and what he accomplished in his stooping there to death and to bring many sons unto glory. Now, in the light of that, consider Jesus Christ. Now, the word "consider" there means more than take a glance at him. It means to look intently upon him, to comprehend who he is, and to come to see the real greatness of Jesus Christ, who is above angels, God's final spokesman, greater than angels or prophets. "Wherefore, holy brethren." Now, he addresses them as holy brethren, and that grows out of what he had pointed out in the second chapter. The second chapter, verse 9, "We behold him who had been made a little lower than the angels, even Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that by the grace of God he should taste of death for every man. For it became him for whom are all things, and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the author of thy salvation perfect through suffering. For both he that sanctified and they that sanctified are all of one, for which cause he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare thy name among my brethren." So inasmuch then as Jesus Christ has sanctified us, and that simply means to set apart as holy, he has set us apart as holy, a separate people unto himself. Now in the light of that, Paul, the writer here, addresses them as holy brethren. "Wherefore, in the light of what I have said, holy brethren, through your relationship now under God through Christ," you remember that Peter said in 1 Peter 1:13-15, "Wherefore, girding up the loins of your mind, be sober, and set your hope perfectly on the glory to be revealed unto you at the coming of Christ." Here he goes on to say it, "And for he said, you shall be holy, for I am holy." So our standard is God himself as the standard of holiness, and we've been set apart unto that holiness through Jesus Christ and the redemption in him. "So wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession." Now notice here, we're partakers of a heavenly calling. It is a heavenly calling because we are called by God himself. In Acts 2:39, Peter said, "Unto you is the promise, and to them that are far off, as many as the Lord our God shall call unto him." And in the Thessalonian letter, both of them, in 2 Thessalonians 2 and 1 Thessalonians 2, both of those chapters, he speaks of the fact that God called you unto his own kingdom and glory, and that he called you through our gospel, right, in those two letters. Right? So God has called us. He has called us through Jesus Christ. He's called us by the gospel. So it is a call from heaven. But second, it's a heavenly calling, because not only are we called from heaven by God, but we're called unto heaven. God has called us unto his own kingdom and glory, that we might share that kingdom and glory with Jesus Christ that God has provided. So truly, folks, it is a heavenly calling. And one that I should appreciate, you should, and we all should really, appreciate it to the intent that we make keep ourselves holy unto him at all times. But remember, God called us to his own holiness that we might share in the glory of that final and eternal kingdom. So wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, even Jesus. Now notice here he called him an apostle and high priest. Well, an apostle is one sent. So here we have God, and Jesus said, yeah, that's what the word means. The word means one sent. The apostle was sent by Christ. And when the church sent Barnabas and Paul out, Barnabas was an apostle, one sent. In that sense, I talked about that some time ago, you remember, from the book of Acts, Sunday or two ago. So he had one sent. Now, in John 7, verse 29, Jesus said, I know him because I am from him, and he hath sent me. Right? So as God sent Christ, Christ then is an apostle here from God unto man. So here he is an apostle. God sent that. God is man. So consider the apostle and high priest of our confession. One who knows God and is from God, because God sent him. God sent him as his apostle. Now, that's the only time I know of that Jesus is spoken of as an apostle, but here he's spoken of because that's what he is. He is one sent from God. Well, as one sent from God, he represented God as an ambassador from God. And now, an ambassador is one who goes in the authority of the one sent. So we consider two things now about Jesus as an apostle. First is, he is sent from God, backed by the authority of God. So all that he does and all that he ever taught, he always claimed God for the authority for what he said and what he taught. Right then, second, as the ambassador representing now the kingdom that sent him, or the king that sent him, he also, his voice is the voice of that one that sent him. So he is an ambassador, all that means comes within the authority of God, and he comes also with the voice of God. So that Jesus constantly claimed, and I've called attention to those passages enough times, but throughout the Gospel of John, Jesus claimed over and over that his message was not his, nor from himself, but from the Father. God gave him the message, so actually he spoke by the authority of God, and he spoke the voice of God as the apostle of God. But now then, here the apostle and high priest. Now as a high priest, now he represents man under God. So here then, he comes from God as the apostle and returns to God as the high priest. So he now represents man under God. Now, in the Latin, the word priest, pontiff or pontifex, means a bridge builder. So really, the word priest from the Latin means a bridge builder. I don't know that that was the original in the Hebrew, but that's what he really is. He is one that bridges the difference or the distance from man to God. So he comes as an apostle of God, and he goes back to God as a high priest of man. Well, now that's what we pointed out last Sunday night from the second chapter there, but beginning with verse about 16, for not unto angel doth he give help, but unto the seed of Abraham. Wherefore it behooved him in all things to be made like unto his brethren, that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining unto God. That is, he represents us before God. So he's both God and man. He came to us as God. He goes back to God as man. That is, as one who sees all of our needs from man's point of view. I pointed that out in one or two of our lessons. That an individual pointed that out in one or two of our lessons. That an individual, I think, can only understand completely a thing as he has experienced that thing. There are some things I can preach on and teach on, and I try to understand, but really, I can't completely understand that unless I've experienced that. And that was Job's problem. Job couldn't understand some things. He'd gone through the experience, then he understood these things. Well, that's what it is with us. So now that Jesus then comes representing God to us, but he goes back to the Father as our high priest, understanding our temptation and trials, from experience, for having been tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. Now, this is what the apostle of the writer of Hebrews is going to point out and show later on in the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters, especially 5 and 7, how that Jesus now is our high priest, and beginning in the 4th chapter, verse 16. But we will leave that when we come to it later on. So wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, God called, as you see, through Christ, but through a heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, even Jesus. So here then is Jesus now, as both the high priest and the apostle. Apostle from God to us, and from us to God. Right? Now notice he moves on from that in the next verse here, having said that now, called an apostle and a prophet, who was faithful in all his house, as was Moses in his house. Now the house here is the family. Now, I was mentioning this morning the fact that to the Greeks, the word house could refer to the family or to the dwelling. Well, sometimes the Bible is talking about the house of God as a temple. Well, that would be a dwelling. Sometimes he talks about the house of God as the family of God, the household of God. We talked about it in our 10:30 class this morning. And I need to understand that. So now then here, he's talking here about the family of God. Now I want you to note wherein he points out that Jesus is greater than Moses. Now notice he says here, inasmuch therefore he hath been counted worthy of more honor, glory than Moses, by so much as he that built the house hath more honor than the house. And he said up here that Jesus now was as a son over his house, but Moses was a servant in the house. And in the family of God, the Old Testament family of God back to Israel, Moses was a servant of God in that family. Now Jesus Christ is greater than he by so much as a son is greater than a servant. He is the son that built the house. Now notice further, he's so much greater than Moses as he that built the house is greater than an individual who's a part of the house. Now he that built all things is God. God is the builder of all things, but God built this house through Christ. Jesus said in Matthew 16:19, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15, I write these things unto you, that you may know how men ought to behave themselves in the house of God, which is the church of the living God. So here the house of God is that family of God, which is the church of the living God, built up of living stones, as Peter said. Talked about that this morning. Right? So here then is the house, and Jesus Christ is God's the builder of the house, but he built it through Jesus Christ, but Jesus Christ built all things. We had that a few Sundays ago in Colossians, the first chapter, in verse 15 there, that everything has been made through Christ. John said the same thing. So Christ then is God's agent in the creation or the establishing, and that word the built there could be translated established. That is, he established the house. He's the one that established it there. Now he moves on to say in that, for he that hath been counted, he had been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, by so much as he that built the house hath more honor than the house. Now every house is built or established by someone, but he that built all things is God. And Moses indeed was faithful in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which were after to be spoken, but Christ as a son over his house, whose house are we, if we hold fast our boldness and the glory of our hope firm unto the end. Right? Now, we also have it back in the first chapter, in verse 10, you recall there, that thou, Lord, did make all things here, then did lay the foundation of the earth and so on. For Jesus Christ was the builder, both the establisher of the family, and also the builder of the house here. The universe, he built all things physical, and now then he's the author of all things spiritual. Right? Now, when you look at Moses, great as he was, and now I want to go in and look at Moses' greatness for just a moment, so that we can appreciate how the Hebrew, the Jew, would feel in this matter. But what this writer is arguing is, God at the end of these days has spoken unto us in his Son. Now the Son stooped, that he might bring many sons unto glory, qualify himself to become a high priest and so on. And now then, he then built the house, and is a son over the house, as a builder of it, and he would be by so much greater than Moses, as the son is greater than the servant, and the builder than simply a member of it. And it's of course, an argument we can all see and appreciate there. But this is the way now he's approaching this matter. Well, as I said a while ago, this would be very difficult for a Jew to accept one that's greater unless he has lots of evidence, sufficient evidence. But when you go back to look at Moses for just a moment, he was born in bondage, you recall. He was hid by his mother when Pharaoh determined the death of all the males. He was hid in this little ark of bulrushes in the Nile there. He was found by the princess. She took him home with her, and he was reared in the palace of the Pharaoh, in the palace of the princess there. And then after a while, he reached an age after a while, he thought it was time to make himself known and deliver his people. But it was an abortive effort, because he no sooner had slain an Egyptian, tried to correct the difference in his brothers there, and they said, "Oh, you're going to kill us like you did the Egyptian." Well, in other words, they didn't recognize the fact. What he was doing was trying to present himself as the deliverer. Well, we had that a few Sundays ago, you remember, in the 7th chapter of Acts, when Stephen preached and pointed that out to them. That when he tried to be a deliverer, well, you rejected him there. And you always have rejected everything God tried to get you to do, or he wanted you to do. And so they looked back at that, and here he wanted to deliver him. He fled then into the land of Midian. He spent 40 years there as a shepherd, shepherding the flocks of Jethro, who became his father-in-law. And then, of course, then the time came to deliver them. And you recall how that they not only had his call. Now, here was his early effort there, and who he was. He was learned and all the educated and all the Egyptian learning of that day. We're told that. So he had all of that. Well, now then, having fled, God appeared to him. God appeared to him in the burning bush and called him to go back down into Egypt and bring my people out of Egypt. Great honor, to be sure. Well, Moses said, "They won't believe me." God said, "What do you have in your hand?" He said, "A rod." He cast it down. Came a serpent. Moses started to run from him. God said, "No, pick it up." He picked it up and went back to a rod again. Well, he left and went. And you recall then how he used that rod as an instrument from God to perform those superhuman, miraculous events. So first of all, he turned the water to blood, there, you remember. Then later on, the frogs came. He brought in the frogs and the lice and the flies and the boars and the murrain of the cattle and all that, and the darkness here in the land there of Egypt. And then finally, the death of all the firstborn. Well, now that certainly would be, that was a wonderful thing, how that he had done all of that. Well, now they remember that. Well, Jesus had performed miracles, Moses had. But Jesus had raised the dead and done other miracles that were, I think, greater than those of Moses. But I know none of them any greater than all of them great miracles. Now then, they're ready to leave. And with the death of the firstborn of all the Egyptians, they started out, came to the Red Sea. Moses lifted his rod here when they were between the army back here and the Red Sea over here. Lifted the rod and the sea parted. The wind dried it up and they went across on dry land into the land now of the Sinaitic Peninsula there, on their way to the Promised Land. But you recall, as they went through, they lacked water. God provided the water and all that, but it came to Mount Sinai. About 2 months later, they came to Sinai, and here God had given them this wonderful law. Moses had gone up into the mountain. God had given them the law written on tables of stone, written by the finger of God. So they had all of that. They came back down. They built the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, to keep that, to carry it, and all that, and they started out. Came to the border of the land of Egypt, of Canaan, rather, and there, because of the false spies, they were turned back for 40 years. Now, during these 40 years, they'd been fed by the manna from heaven. They had Moses speak to strike the rock once, and he's supposed to speak to it the second time, but he smote it again. God gave them water. They remember then how that God had provided them with. And, of course, it sounds a lot better. When you get 1,500 or 1,200 years away from that, 1,500 years, well, that sounds so much greater than it did to them then. But after all that God had done for them back there, in leading them in these 40 years, and finally died on Mount Nebo and was buried there at the end of the 40 years' time. And then, of course, they had the wonderful work of Joshua as they went into the land and went in and possessed this land that God had promised them. But over in this 95th Psalm, you have it, which quoted again. I'm going to read it from the Hebrew letter in just a moment. But let's go back and read it from the Psalm itself here. That 95th Psalm is a Psalm that deals with the greatness of God as they're called upon here to worship and to praise God, and then how that they'd reacted to it, what they had done back there. 95th Psalm is kind of a short psalm. Several of them right along here that are very beautiful. One of those, "Oh, come, let us sing unto the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before his presence with thanksgiving and make a joyful noise unto him with psalms. For the Lord is great, is a great God, and a great king above all gods. In his hand are the deep places of the earth. The strength of the hills is his also. The sea is his, and he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, who is our God, and we are the people of His pasture and the sheep of His hand. Now, there's the greatness of God. And they recognize that, and that Moses, the servant of God, and all of that. Now, notice, today, if you will hear His voice, harden not your heart as in the provocation. Now, that looks back to the time in the wilderness there when it provoked God. And as in the day of temptation in the wilderness, when your fathers tempted me, proved me, and saw my work, 40 years long was I grieved for this generation, and said, it is a people that do err in their heart, and they have not known my ways, unto whom I swear in my wrath, that they should not enter into my rest. Now, in spite of all the greatness of God and the greatness of Moses as the servant of God that led them out, yet they had failed to live according to the standard when they went into the land, and therefore God didn't give them the rest He had promised. Now, I want to talk about that from the 4th chapter next Sunday night, the Lord willing. I want to look at that, the rest that God promised, which they really never entered into that rest. God swear they should not enter into that rest, and they didn't. We gave them the land, but it was never a land of rest. They were always at war and battling and all that. All right, now come back. Now, that was the greatness of God. All right, now notice here, beginning now with about verse 6, I think is where I stopped, or 7. All right, now here we have the quotation. When he says, therefore, wherefore, even as the Holy Spirit said. So the Holy Spirit was speaking through the psalmist that wrote that psalm that we just read. Today, if you shall hear His voice, harden not your hearts as in the provocation, like as in the day of the trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me by proving me, and saw my works 40 years. Wherefore I was displeased with this generation, and said that they do always err in their heart. You remember that Stephen called attention to this. They were always, but they did not know my ways. They didn't come to understand. Well, yeah, they heard them. Moses read the law. They had the law read to them. But it's one thing to hear a thing, it's another to know it. Jesus said, this is life eternal. They should know thee, the only true God, him whom thou didst send. It's one thing to know an individual. It's another thing to know about him. It's one thing to know about these ways. It's another thing to know them in the sense of following them in the life that we live. So this is what he's saying now under this. But they did not know my ways, as I swear in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. All right? Now, with that read before them, now comes the warning unto the Christians now on the basis of that. And what has he done? He's looked back to what God did through Moses, how he used Moses to lead them out. Now then, when they came into the wilderness there, how they rebelled against it. And in their rebellion, over and over, he brought them into the land, and they continued to rebel against him. They never did know his ways in practice. And as a result, they never entered into the rest that God had promised them. They entered the land, but no rest. And that's what we're going to show from the 4th chapter. It goes on in the 4th chapter to point that out. All right? But now notice what it says. Take heed. All right? Here's the first thing here. Now, in the light of all of this Old Testament here, what happened under Moses here, now take heed here. Look out. Be careful. Watch, he says here. I take heed, brethren, lest haply there should be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief. All right? Now, here's the warning. All right? Now, take heed as a warning. A warning of what? Warning here that there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief. Now remember, a few Sundays ago, we talked from the 2nd chapter about drifting slip away from you, or drift away from you there, and neglect. Right? Now an individual can drift away, or he can neglect. Or as he continues to neglect and to do that, there will be developed within him an evil heart of unbelief. Right? We're going to learn now from this what unbelief actually is. Here he goes on. Lest there be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief in falling away from the living God. Well, as those of the Old Testament fell away, so can you under the new fall away. We can fall away. God's made it possible for us not to. But we can fall away. Right? So long as it's called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. I think that's one of the really, truly great warnings in the New Testament. Is harden not your hearts, lest you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Sin is so deceitful. An individual doesn't think he's going to wind up where he utterly winds. He doesn't intend to. But sin deceives him. And so take heed, lest anyone be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. So he goes on to say now, for we'll become partakers of Christ if Now look at that little if and encircle it. If we hold fast the beginning of our confidence, firm unto the end. Now this idea of being, we're his pasture, we're the sheep of his pasture, back in that 95th Psalm. We're the sheep of his pasture. Right now, we're the sheep of his pasture, but we can't jump over the fence now and back and forth here. Live as a Christian for a while and go back the other way a while and then come back and go back there. We're his children, we're his sons here. If we hold fast the beginning of our confidence, firm unto the end. Now that is not to say that an individual cannot sin and repent and come back. It doesn't say that. But what it is, what God insists upon is that an individual don't take that chance. Because if you begin to drift, you begin to neglect, the heart is gradually hardened more and more. And as it's hardened, and after a while it's in unbelief, and so we don't ever get back or come back and fail to enter into the rest that God's provided for us. Now, just as they fail to enter into the rest provided for them, we can fail to enter into the rest provided for us. Therefore, take heed. I don't think we ought to go around all, well, I'm just scared to death, I'm going to do wrong, I'm scared to do this or that. No, we shouldn't do that. Christian life should be a life of joy and happiness and gladness and all of that. But I should always be on my guard that I am made out of the same kind of dirt that Adam was, just exactly. We all came the same parent stock. And the weakness that manifested in Eve and Adam can also be manifested in me. I can make the same errors, and so can you. So the thing here is, what he's saying is, take heed. Be on your guard. Beware here, lest there be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief in falling away from the living God. But now notice he goes on to say here, but he said, if we hold fast the beginning of our confidence, firm unto the end. While it said today. Now notice the same thing back on it was today in the 95th Psalm. It's still today over here in the 3rd chapter of Hebrews. We're always living today. My temptations always come today. I'm not tempted by anything yesterday. I'm not tempted by anything of tomorrow. It's today here. Right? Now today, if you would hear his voice, harden not your hearts as in the provocation. But I'll overlook one point up here. When he said an evil heart, take heed lest haply that any one of you an evil heart of them may fall away. But exhort one another. Now here is, first of all, take heed there, the warning. Now here is another, is exhort one another, day by day, so long as it's called today, lest any be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. I'm going ahead of myself. Right? Now here, exhort one another. Now here is a personal responsibility laid upon the Christian here in this 3rd chapter and over in the 10th chapter, which we'll look at later on when we come to it, here. To exhort one another day by day, so long as it's called today, lest there be in any one of an evil heart of unbelief and falling away from the living God. Here is a personal responsibility. Each of us is really his brother's keeper. Old Cain asked the question back out, am I my brother's keeper? Yes. God answered that question in Jesus Christ. I'm not responsible for his sin. I'm responsible as a relationship to him as a brother to do all I can for him. Exhort one another day by day, so long as it's called today, lest have any of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. I'm asking the question here to one another here, and lest any be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. I'm asking the question, do we really take that seriously? I don't think so. I don't think any of us, we say, well, that's not my responsibility. If he wants to go to hell, let him go. That's his going. That's what he's doing. Now, I can't look at it that way. I can't look at it that way. To the extent of my ability, I am my brother's keeper. We must realize it. So exhort one another day by day. I don't do that. And I don't think you do. I don't think any of us do. But it's another one of those things the Lord told us to do that I ought to take as seriously as I do any other command, shouldn't I? If not, why not? So each other does have a responsibility. In our morning studies at 10:30, I'll be pointing out soon what the responsibility of all of us is in building the church. Now then, after we have instructed individuals and helped them to come under the Lord, now then, what is my responsibility after that? To exhort one another day by day, so long as it's called today. Lest happen any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin, for we become partakers of Christ, if so be that we hold fast the beginning of our confidence firm unto the end. So here's the ground on which I am a partaker here of Christ, and here's that little if. I've said so many times, that's the biggest little word in any language. If so be. Here's a conditional if. Sometimes the if is not conditional. It is here. If so be. we hold fast the beginning of our confidence firm unto the end. Now notice what he says further. I've got several things I want to look at here. We're moving along now. Now he goes on to say here, if we hold fast, while it is said today, if you shall hear his voice, harden not your hearts, as in the provocation, for who, when they heard, did provoke? Nay, did not all that are. Now here then, we're talking here about this matter of unbelief. Right? Now we look at this matter of unbelief. Here it is. It's unbelief. And we're going to come back to it over here, unbelief over here. Now it showed me that what did they do? They provoked God. All right, that to be not in any of you an evil. Remember the provocation here. Now it goes on, for who, when they heard, did provoke? Nay, did not all they that came out of Egypt by Moses. Now here they're talking about going back to Moses. Well, most of those that left by Moses never got there. Why do you want to go back to him when I hear Christ so much greater has spoken the final word? They provoked him under Moses back there. All right, they provoked God. That's to turn him against you, anger God. All that came out of Egypt by Moses. And with whom was he displeased 40 years? Was it not with them that sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness here? Right, and here's the one who was displeased with. Now remember, to be not in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief. That's what we're talking about, that evil heart of unbelief. Right, now notice this, those that sinned here, whose bodies fell in the wilderness. Now you notice another thought here. And to whom was he displeased? That they should not enter into his rest, but to them that were disobedient. We see, therefore, they were not able to enter in because of unbelief. Now, he starts out here with unbelief, moves on here to provoking God by sinning and disobedience, and fail to enter in because of unbelief. Now, that, I think, is a very important lesson to learn. We think of an individual in unbelief as one who just comes out and says, no, I don't believe in God at all. But how many are those who say, oh, yes, I believe that God is? And I believe all right. These folk get back down. When they came out of Egypt, it said back there in the 14th chapter of Exodus, speaks there of their being saved by their faith, by their belief there. Right? But now, belief expresses itself in action and obedience, which I talked about back in the 2nd chapter of Acts when we're on that. Disobedience finds expression here also in provoking God by sinning in disobedience to God. For any disobedience to God is the expression of a heart of unbelief. I don't believe it to the extent I've got to do what God said do. But I have. So it's an extremely important lesson here that we learn here. So now that we look at that, now let me just for a few minutes, and I've got just a very few minutes more. Let me look now at this matter here of how we can do this ourselves today. Now, here now, if here provoking God by sinning and disobedience, if I call that unbelief, all right, take heed as a warning, give an exhortation to exhort one another, you lest you be hardened by unbelief, and we become a partaker if we hold fast the beginning of our confidence firm unto the end. Now, I want to turn to 1 Corinthians 10 for just a moment. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10 there, to those brethren now, that if I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that our fathers were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the cloud and in the sea, and they all drank of the same spiritual drink, and I mean ate of the same spiritual food. They drank of the same spiritual drink, for they drank of the rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Now Paul is doing in 1 Corinthians 10 about what the writer of Hebrews was doing here, except they're both approaching it from a little different point of view. Howbeit, with most of them, now going back to 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, now he said, these things were our example to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Right? Neither be idolaters as some of them. For it's written, the people sat down to drink, even to drink, and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication. They also committed and fell in one day 23,000. Neither he said to not let us make trial of the Lord, as they made trial of the Lord and perished by the serpent. Neither murmur ye, as they also murmured and perished by the destroyer. Alright, I said, these things were our examples. These were written for our admonition, by whom the ends of the ages are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall, for there is no temptation taken you but such as man can bear, for God is faithful. Who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation supply also the means of escape, that you may be able to endure it. That carries you down from verse 1 to verse 13 now. Right? Now let's look now at what Paul specifies what they did. Here he says, now first of all, they lusted after evil things. Well, and I think after getting that 12th chapter of Numbers, I believe, when there be mixed multitude among them, lusted strongly for the cucumbers and the leeks and the garlics and the onions of Egypt there. And God fed them, but he wasn't pleased with it. They lusted after those various things there. That's a strong desire for it. Then he said, let us be idolaters, or commit idolatry. They committed back there. Well, you remember the 32nd chapter of Exodus, when Moses went upon the mount to get the tables of stone there, the commandments. They built the golden calf there. Well, God was displeased with that, and some 3,000 of them perished as a result of their worshiping that golden calf there. All right? And then neither let us make trial of the Lord. So they made trial of him. Well, that was over and over that they would try him back there, and they were perished by the serpents when they made trial of him. God sent those fiery serpents among them, and they perished by them. Neither let us commit fornication, some of them committed. Well, you remember when they came to the borders of Moab, old Balaam was the one who suggested this to the king of Moab there, king of Balak, that you send out your daughters, entice them here to come worship with these gods, in which fornication, immorality, was a part of it. Well, you remember they did that, and 23,000 of them perished upon that occasion there. Right? And then they constantly murmured. God sent the destroyer among them and destroyed them there. So here's a look at that. Neither let us lust after things that they lusted. Neither be idolaters, they were idolaters. Neither let us commit fornication as they did. Let us not make trial of the Lord as they made trial. Let us not murmur as they murmured there. So here were specific sins that they committed under Moses and perished as a result of it. But they are sins that we can commit today and also perish. Now, an idolatry isn't one necessarily. You just have to bow down to an image. Covetousness is idolatry. Or we can murmur about things, and really, if we think of God as being in control, then really murmuring against God. And so when we look at all of this, this third chapter here is a very important chapter here. Consider the apostle and high priest of our profession, even Jesus. Now, Christ is much greater than Moses, as the son is greater than the servant. The builder of the house is greater than the house itself, which Moses was a member of that. Right? Now, we don't deny the greatness of Moses. Moses was truly one of the greatest characters of the Old Covenant. Now, he and Abraham and David, there were a number of them. I wouldn't say one greater than the other. He was among the greatest back then, because he was the lawgiver, the leader, and all of that, as they brought him into the land of Canaan there, the land that God was going to give them. But through that wilderness there, they had rebelled against God, and as they got into the land, they continued to rebel against him. So he never gave them the rest that he had promised. All right? So now then, the warning is, you take heed, lest there be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief in falling away. So in practicing these things that Paul said they practiced back yonder, that would be an expression or an action of unbelief in God. God said, don't do that. God forbid that be done now. But I go ahead, I don't believe what God said. I'm not showing faith by what I did. And so the chapter here is a great chapter. Look to him, Jesus Christ, who is our high priest, our apostle from God that brought the message to him, called us unto a heavenly calling. He went back to represent us before the Father, and so does now. And we have all of the Old Testament, illustrate the Old Testament. There are good things and there are bad things. As an illustration to us, as examples to us, we should be warned about them or encouraged by them. Some of them we're encouraged by. Some we're warned by. But that's what they are. So when we preach the Old Testament, not that I'm under it, but these were written for our admonition from whom the ends of the ages are come. They're our example here to show us what faithfulness is, what unfaithfulness is. I think we need always to learn that lesson. Keep it before us at all times. Well, we'll leave the lesson there at this time here, and we'll stand together and sing the song. It's been selected. I want to call it next time for the fourth chapter on the rest that they fail to enter into and awaits us. Let's stand together while we sing.